meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:05 on Thursday, February 16th, in room 106 of the State Capitol. Members present are Representative Keto, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber and Alex Beebe Judiche from the House Hess and Juno LIO staffing for staffing the committee today. And then we'll be finishing our presentation today from the Department of Health and Social Services on the recommendations regarding privatizing the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Corey Jones from Public Consulting Group will be presenting over the phone, along with Randall Burns in the room.
He's
Randall Burns, the Director of Division of Behavioral Health, is also online. Lori Morton, Program Coordinator for the Division of Behavioral Health, is facilitating the slide presentation here in the room. And I believe that we left off on slide 9. So I want to ask everybody to limit questions and comments to clarifying questions on technical aspects until the end of the presentation, so we can just make sure we get through it all today. Mr. Jones, are you online?
Yes, I am.
All right, fantastic. You ready to hit the road?
Sure. We can jump right into it. Again, I'll say for the record, Corey Jones, I'm a consultant with PCG. I just want to pick up where we left off during the last meeting. I am going to talk about the findings and recommendations today. I believe we have one slide left on the staffing requirements. That just lists why we made the decisions that we made regarding the administrative reductions to administrative FTEs as well as nursing FTEs. On the administrative FTEs, we assume that there were built-in efficiencies for a private entity. Many of these kinds of entities, they're part of a broader network of hospitals, and things like IT, quality assurance, those sorts of functions we believe could be absorbed by the larger enterprise. So positions that API needs, because it's the only entity within the state that does that function, some of those could simply be absorbed in functions that already exist. When it comes to the nursing, we rely pretty heavily on our look at peer hospitals and the staffing levels we've found there, as well as the recommendations, as industry recommendations about the minimum staffing you would need for registered nurses in a psychiatric context. California requires a 1-to-6 nursing ratio with registered nurses, for instance. So that's a benchmark that we find in the industry. And we found that API stands very close to that right now. So many of the cuts that we recommended to the nursing staff are not to the registered nurses, but to nursing aides, so the psychiatric nursing assistants, PNAs. So we also looked at what the minimum staffing is in terms of the physical requirements and the layout of the hospital, and people who are on let's call it close observation status that require 1-on-1, even 2-to-1 nursing ratios. API does a good job of recording the amount of time required by close observation status. So over the course of a year, we could look at what the nursing requirements are. So we found, based on that at a minimum, you would need 18.1 nursing staff at any time in the hospital. Our recommendations are at 21.2 nursing staff at any given time. That's what it calculates out to. So there's a little slack on our recommendations over the bare minimum, but not much. So we think those recommendations are reflective of what you can do safely with direct care. Anything lower than that really does kind of begin to threaten service delivery at the hospital. So with that, I'll go ahead and move into the findings and recommendations on slide 12. The first, just as a kind of reminder of what our options were, we had full privatization, a variation of that, which is a joint operating agreement between the state and a private entity. We recommended efficiencies that could be implemented under current management, and then we had what we're calling component outsourcing, which involves looking at individual components and the desirability of privatizing pieces of the hospital, but not the entire hospital. So on slide 12, this is a high level, kind of a highlight of our more detailed cost benefit analysis. Even though it says option one full privatization, as a reminder, this is everything that we say at full privatization is also true of a joint operating agreement, so we don't really cover that independently. Looking at the benefits, one of the things that was, I think, pointed out by numerous stakeholders is that that private operators often have more flexibility in how they can tailor their compensation packages as well as scheduling. There are just certain features of the public sector that are a little bit more rigid about how both how compensation works as well as how things get scheduled. So there was at least a sense that one of the benefits for the private operator to bring into it is to tailor those different variables that would improve recruitment and retention of qualified employees. You may know that there's been trouble retaining in the past, at least. There's been trouble retaining psychiatrists on the one hand, and even though there is a substantial contingent of long-term employees at API, especially on the kind of the floor level, the P&A level, there can be quite a bit of churn for employees. So recruitment and retention is a significant issue, and that's one of the areas where a private operator could be helpful. Again, a lot of that is speculation because we didn't really have any good way to quantify how a package would have an effect. So it's a potential benefit. Another benefit is the DBH where it can get out of the game with providing that direct service, it would create probably more consistency with the role that it plays on the side of community services. As you may know, operating the hospital is one of the few direct services the DBH provides. In other contexts, with community services, it is more the contract manager, and that those services are provided by the private sector. So in a way, it could really have that role in terms of inpatient services as well. And it's a big use of DBH resources right now. Not just operating the hospital, but outside of the hospital, there's a fair amount of work that gets done coordinating the transition between API and the movement into and out of community services. So that's constantly monitored what the bed capacity is and monitoring admissions and discharges by DBH. So it would one of the benefits would be to relieve DBH of that duty and the contractor could take on a lot of that, and DBH could not function with kind of more high-level administrative duties and ensuring that that there's a high-quality system. Another potential benefit is that the private contractor has some autonomy to implement some of the needed changes at API because of the flexibility in hiring and implementation of different kinds of service delivery options, that may be what is needed to actually make some of the improvements. So that's one of the potential benefits that a private contractor could shake things up and implement some needed changes there. The drawbacks that we found, they're also fairly substantial, and one of the reasons we ultimately recommended against the full privatization is that we found that it was cost prohibitive. We found that it did not, in fact, save the state money, even under the recommended staffing scenario. So even when you reduce overall compensation and reduce some of the FTEs in the hospital, we found that it was overall still more costly than running it as a public sector entity. Some of those things are additional contract monitoring costs, termination liability costs to retirement fund, The additional margins that would be required for both by nonprofit or for-profit entity. The other way to get around some of those additional costs that were in our model was ultimately to minimize some of the contract monitoring costs or not to build in safeguards to ensure that staffing wasn't cut to kind of below minimum levels to maintain service delivery. So we have seen that in other contexts where the hospital cuts too low because of the same sort of budgetary pressures that Alaska's under. Florida is a good example of that where this is an effect of the whole system, not just the private entity, but if you're in a budget crisis and there's no money, sometimes you can cut below a minimum level, and you do see effects in the injury rate and just issues that emerge at the hospital. So we didn't see that it was any kind of cost savings unless you kind of cut corners that are not safe to cut. So that was true of both the full privatization and the joint operating agreement options. So slide 13, we've got a big graphic of a thumbs down. That was most of our reasons for recommending against this option were with fiscal. It ultimately just doesn't produce the kinds of savings that are important to the state. Moving to option 3 on slide 14, one of the benefits I'll start with the benefits column here. Most of the areas of increased efficiency that we saw were not dependent on a private operator. So there were changes to scheduling or changes of abilities to run leaner both on the administrative side and the direct service side that really did not depend on whether it's public sector or private sector. So we do see as one of the benefits of this option that some of the changes that we saw as possibilities could be implemented under continued state management. Another benefit is the state would be able to continue to retain kind of full control and accountability of this very important service layer in behavioral health services. And as everyone knows, this is an extremely vulnerable population. Keeping it within kind of public scrutiny, public accountability is important from a fundamental civil rights perspective as well. So that's a benefit of this sort of option. When you privatize, you do kind of create potential principal agent problems that makes contract monitoring extremely important, and that's additional costs. So there's no new additional costs related to those sorts of contract administration issues or potential new legal liabilities. We found that the state management option still produces the greatest amount of value and cost savings to the state. If the service delivery recommendations that we made could be implemented, this option gives the greatest possibility of savings. There are any kind of termination liability costs that you would have in a privatization scenario. So overall, it's fiscally the most advantageous option, and all the service delivery changes that you could get under a private entity, you could get under the public entity as well. The drawbacks are you still have higher staffing expenditures than you would have under a private entity. You retain all that administrative burden that DBH currently has. A big question that was posed by some stakeholders was whether some of the changes and reductions that we identified as potential improvements could be implemented in a public entity. Those are the big options for us. So overall, looking at slide 15, we recommend that is both feasible and our number one recommended option. Moving on to slide 16, looking at the kind of component outsourcing options, we identified four different options. One was to privatize the communication centers, basically the front desk, security, and reception. And then option two was the environmental services and maintenance and things like that. We found with the communication center and to a lesser extent with maintenance and environmental services, that those were kind of the potential for large savings is there. I mean, these aren't big assets of a hospital, but given what the costs are now, you have, you know, potentially significant savings within those cost centers. Especially with the communication center outsourcing, we didn't see any really strong drawbacks to privatizing the communication center. So in slide 17 is very confident and thumbs up. Slide 18, the benefits and drawbacks of the facility and material management outsourcing are essentially the same as the communication center. There are kind of fewer savings available there. There aren't big differences between a private operator and a public operator, but we did find that there would be some minimal level of savings. So we recommend that as a privatization option to pursue as well. Looking at slide 20, at psychiatry and the medical services, basically privatizing the physician component of the hospital. Both psychiatrists and there are a few medical doctors, there are some medical services that API has to provide. We looked at that option and we didn't find that was feasible, mostly because that doesn't tend to be a component in privatization where costs are reduced. In fact, most privatization efforts we've seen actually increase the cost because they pay the physicians a little bit more generally in benefits and salaries in order to improve retention. So we found that was true in our models as well, that under privatization, the costs of the psychiatrists actually go up. It was significant increases in costs under a private operator. So that's why on slide 21 we get a thumbs down. Moving to slide 22, looking at nursing staff, this is one where we didn't recommend yes or no on the nursing staff, mainly because we found that while it is feasible under assumptions about a non-profit operator, a for-profit operator was not feasible from a fiscal perspective. And it was not clear who the vendor of a privatized nursing outsourcing would be in the Alaska context. You don't have a kind of a strong university nursing program or providers where there's just a significant pool of nurses available. So given that there's not strong cost savings there, we recommended being very cautious about whether that was worth implementing. So you see this on slide 23, you see this yellow hand raise, be careful. And looking at moving to slide 24, our last component outsourcing action was comprehensive, basically privatizing all direct services and only leaving the state as the administrator of that hospital. We found that also was not feasible, mainly because of the increased cost of the physician staff. So on fiscal grounds, we didn't find that was feasible, that there weren't any cost savings to the state. So that's pretty much the high level run-through of our findings and recommendations. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Representative Johnston?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions. One is, I was just curious at this point as far as the psychiatric staff, is that fully staffed at this point? Do we have full staffing for our medical providers?
Yeah, my understanding is that it's fully staffed at this point. So at times in the recent past, the recent couple of years, there's been a heavy reliance on locum tenens, substitute physicians. And it's fully staffed at this point, though, you know, I was consistently cautioned throughout the project that it's really one or two physicians away from having to go back to, you know, locum tenens. Um, So, but at this point, it is a full staff complement of psychiatrists.
Madam Chair, if I might, this is Randall Burns. I would just like to add, as Mr. Jones mentioned, indeed, it is a fragile system, and a psychiatrist just gave notice, and so we are now down a psychiatrist.
So through the chair, it's something that kind of goes back and forth between fully staffed and then using more transient providers. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, through the chair, Representative Johnson. Yes, that's correct. Sometimes we, if we use locum tenens psychiatrists, if individuals are on extensive leave. And we also sometimes, if someone has sick leave or something of that nature, we may have to use a locum.
So we could almost call it a hybrid.
Yes.
Through the chair, another question?
Sure.
I've spent quite a bit of time with termination studies, and I was just kind of curious. You seem to, I mean, I don't know how you came at the $2 million, and then it looks like nursing is the largest staff. If that was 1.4 million dollars of the termination studies, where did you get your figures for termination studies?
So yeah, I would like to be very clear that the figure we use is exactly $2 million, and that's to highlight the fact that it's very much a rough approximation. So our figures come from the Department of Administration. So short of actually doing a termination study, which would require, you know, pretty complex variables about when it's happening and who are the staff involved and what their ages are and those sorts of things, the closest that they were able to approximate was to look at past cases of similar sets of studies. So, and I think it was in the 90s, there was a public hospital of similar size to API that, where there was a termination study involved. And that was approximately $2 million with the termination liability of that. And we kept it at $2 million under the assumption that while costs would likely have increased since the 90s, the benefit package, the retirement benefit package is in some ways significantly different from that time. So $2 million was just a rough estimate, and we didn't have any kind of more fine-grained approach than that.
So basically, you were suggesting that it was an issue, and probably we should just drop it at that. Is that correct?
Right. We wanted to represent the scale of what the liability would likely be without trying to make it look more concrete than it is in terms of how we estimated that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm just wondering, and I'm pleased to see these results because I could not oppose this more strongly in terms of how we take care of individuals with serious mental illness. And I'm just curious, though, on the couple of items that you did say were, you know, gave the thumbs up for the outsourcing. For example, on the call center portion of it, I'm just wondering how you deal with sensitive health information. If you have that outsourced as like basically a call center, it's a lot different to me than, you know, calling because my internet is down and getting somebody at a call center than having to call about a family member's serious mental illness. And I'm just thinking there must be ways that that works, but I don't have enough information to understand that.
Oh, sure. In this case, I think the main communication center is a little deceptive. It's really the front desk of API. So it has a reception function in terms of being a front door and a security function. So it's really the security guards that you would find in a government building, which are in other cases often privatized. But API, these are employees of the hospital. So we saw this sort of right for privatization, that these are just essentially security guards, and there are plenty of vendors in Alaska, and it could be done significantly cheaper than it is currently.
Madam Chair, this is Randall Burns. May I reply to that as well?
Go ahead.
Yeah, We have other contracts, for instance, for the transportation of patients, and as long as we have business agreements under the HIPAA, we're allowed to, that's how we would manage the confidentiality issues. We would have business agreements with the entities, with the entity involved in providing that service.
This is Chair Sponholz. You referenced significant savings, and I read the report, but I can't pull up the number in my foggy, cold, addled brain right now. Can you remind me what significant savings would mean?
Sure. Under the state management option.
No, under private management of the communication center. I'm sorry, I was following up on Representative Tuck.
So it's significant from the perspective of the total cost of the communication center. It's a very small component of the hospital, but let me pull it up right here. Under a for-profit entity, that would be about $233,000 a year saved. By the state, but that's a 62% savings in terms of what's spent currently.
Thank you. Is there any other questions for Mr. Jones or Mr. Burns while we have them? All right. Seeing none, I would like to call this committee meeting to an end. It is 3:32, and this meeting is now adjourned. However, please note that the House Finance Subcommittee meeting will begin momentarily.